Welcome to the Netzpolitik podcast. My name is Markus Beckedahl. My guest today is Marvin Amori from Free Press, or formerly known Free Press.
Well, I'm a law professor at Nebraska and an advisor to Free Press, their first lawyer.
Okay, first lawyer.
Well, however you want to do it.
Yeah. Thank you for being here, and sorry for being stranded in Berlin because of the volcano in Iceland.
It's my pleasure to be stranded here with you, Marcus.
Can you give a short introduction, what you are doing and why you are here?
Why I was here in Berlin? Okay, great. I was here in Berlin to speak at the Republica conference, which I did a few days ago. And there was an entire track on network neutrality, which is a technology policy, media policy issue. That's been debated in the United States, and that has become subject to debate in Europe as well.
And why are you involved in the net neutrality debate?
Great. So network neutrality is a proposed policy that would forbid internet service providers, and in the US that's mainly phone and cable companies, it would forbid internet service providers from interfering with the internet, from blocking certain websites, from picking winners and losers by speeding up certain websites, slowing down others, and in general, you know, it's a means of keeping the internet open and free as it has traditionally been. My involvement with net neutrality grows out of my personal work in free speech, democracy, and therefore media policy, and over to open internet. And I was one of the lead activists in the United States and the head lawyer for the leading organization working on network neutrality. I am most well known in the US for bringing a complaint and a case against Comcast, a major cable company, the largest cable company in the US, when Comcast was violating network neutrality by interfering with peer-to-peer applications.
Yeah, we will come later to that case.
Sure.
You're an advisor for Free Press. Can you explain what Free Press is?
Free Press is it's a large media advocacy organization in the United States. It's a nonprofit. It accepts no money from any corporation. It only accepts money from individuals and foundations. It is also nonpartisan, so it doesn't support the Republicans or the Democrats. It is just an organization that works with people across the, you know, we would say across the political aisle, on the right and the left, to ensure a more democratic media, a media that has many different owners, many different outlets, not just a few powerful companies controlling all the outlets. And as part of that mission to keep the media open and free and subject to many voices, it's been very active on open internet policy, trying to keep the internet open and free and available to all Americans. It's mainly a domestic American organization, so that all citizens, all Americans, can speak with one another without having to get permission from any phone company, cable company, or broadcaster.
Mm-hmm. How does the net neutrality debate started in the United States, and when?
So the net neutrality debate started probably as early as 1998, when law professors started writing large articles about the internet and the democratic promise of the internet, and started predicting threats to the internet. And the first articles were probably by Yochai Benkler, now at Harvard, Larry Lessig, now at Harvard, and Mark Lemley, now at Stanford. And they argued that the internet was open partly because people could choose their own internet service provider. So if you had a phone company, usually people have one phone company to their house, and in the US we have one phone company, one cable company. If you had to choose one of those two as your internet service provider, they would have the market power and the ability to interfere with your internet traffic, and you wouldn't have any other ISP to choose. You wouldn't be able to choose another ISP. In the US, we had AOL, Earthlink, NetZero. So the professors predicted that without independent ISPs, the carriers would be able to take over the internet and determine where you could go, and that would really undermine democracy, flourishing of democracy, and even economic innovation that we had seen in terms of new technologies. So for the next few years, the fight centered on whether or not the Federal Communications Commission, which I'll call the FCC, which is the regulator of technology in the US, whether or not the FCC would ensure access for independent ISPs or would permit the phone and cable companies to control whatever ISP uses their lines, and usually it would just be the ISP that that phone company owned. So in about 2002 to 2005, the Bush administration eliminated the open ISP rules, meaning that there would only be, for all Americans, two choices, your phone company or your cable company. And right when that decision was made in 2005, a few months later, the CEO of AT&T, our largest phone company, announced that he wanted to start blocking things on the internet and charging Google and Vonage, of online phone company, to use his pipes. And so that's when it began, the end of 2005, and the fight has been in earnest for the last 4 years.
So Free Press started a campaign called SaveTheInternet.com. Can you describe how the campaign was built up and what kinds of actions you did?
Sure. So following the statements by AT&T in December of 2005, a few months later, around February, one of the top lawyers for Verizon, another phone company, made similar remarks. And it turned out that there was a bill going through Congress that the phone companies really wanted. And our legislative strategy in DC was to amend that bill with a net neutrality requirement, hoping that the bill would pass with that requirement or that that requirement would kill the bill. And that was the inside, sort of inside DC strategy. And in order to effectuate any change in DC, we needed an outside strategy as well, a strategy outside of DC to get the public involved. Because generally the way it works in the United States is when the public isn't involved in a decision, often the most powerful companies can get their way, can push the politicians in a certain direction, and there'd be no political counterweight from the public. So we had to get the public as involved as we could. And so the outside strategy was largely this coalition called SaveTheInternet.com. Save the Internet grew to include 800 organizations, a very diverse range of organizations, some very large ones, including in the United States, the ACLU, it's a civil liberties organization, as well as a lot of strange bedfellows, we would call them, organizations that usually do not agree with one another, such as a group on the far left, which people would think MoveOn.org would be on the far left in the U.S., and an organization on the far right, like the Christian Coalition, a very conservative Christian organization that tended to support George Bush. And all of them came together and said, we agree on one thing, which is we want to be able to communicate with whoever we want to communicate with, our supporters, or people who disagree with us, and to be able to use the internet to do that. And so Save the Internet was part of the outside strategy, 800 organizations, 2 million people altogether. And then I'll talk in a minute about some of the activities they engaged in. Another part of the strategy included, there were some companies that were part of another coalition. Save the Internet was just nonprofits and small businesses. And these companies that support net neutrality included Google and eBay and Amazon at the time, because they didn't want to have to get permission from the phone and cable companies either. And beyond Save the Internet, there were just millions of people who were using the Internet to communicate with each other to spread the message.
Yeah, and what kind of actions did you did?
Sure. So SaveTheInternet.com, let's begin with the name Save the Internet, if I'm not wrong, came from some activists. We didn't know who it was. One of our taglines was use the internet to save the internet, also came from an activist. A lot of the best thinking about what activities to take came from people who were unaffiliated with Free Press, unaffiliated with Save the Internet. I mean, the beauty of the internet, why it's such a great democratic force, is because there are people out there who know how to do cool stuff and who care deeply and can communicate with each other about it. So there was a flowering of YouTube videos. We didn't commission, we didn't ask for, flowering of YouTube videos that went viral, that were very, very popular. There was one involving a ninja. There's a celebrity ninja on YouTube that was very popular. And there are other clips that people would just make and spread. People would just spread the message on their own. So a lot of the activities we did that we get credit for, we didn't have much to do with. We helped coordinate them after they were made, after they started spreading. Some of the activities that we did engage in, one of the benefits was that we could coordinate our inside and outside strategy. We would know from our inside DC strategy which senators and congressmen were most important. And those would be the people who were on the committee that governed the internet. So let's take the Senate as an example. In the US, we have two houses, a lower house, the House of Representatives, and upper house, the Senate. The Senate has 100 senators. And we didn't have to get the public to message all of them at the same time, year round. What we had to do is we had to know these 22 senators are on the Commerce Committee. These 22 senators on the Commerce Committee include 10 votes we'll never ever get, 8 votes we've already got, and several that are up for grabs. So we could channel the outside energy towards those few senators. We could focus our organizing in a few states where those senators were represented. And so that was very helpful. We also knew when the public should make their voice heard. We knew when an important vote was coming up. We knew when an important committee hearing was coming up. And it was at those times when the senators would most need to hear, next week during the hearing, make sure that you show your support for net neutrality, Senator X. Make sure you ask this question of the FCC chairman. So what Save the Internet could do was really coordinate the inside-outside game very well. And the best example of that is there was an August recess during August, which is really, really hot in Washington, D.C., and it's hot everywhere, I think. During August, the congressmen will go home to their district, and they'll campaign, and they'll have town hall meetings, and they'll meet with their constituents, the people who voted for them, and they'll get out of D.C. for that month. And we knew during that month that there were a few senators, I think maybe 5 or 6, that we really wanted to understand that they should support net neutrality. And so we organized demonstrations in all these cities, right outside all of these senators' offices. And within a week or so, several undecided senators came out very quickly and very clearly for net neutrality, being faced with constituents at their home who were very eager to have net neutrality supported by them. So those are some of the things we did.
I remember a great video on YouTube by Ted Stevens.
Oh, yes.
Senator with a series of tubes from one of the hearings.
Yes. So one of the things that the internet makes possible, I mean, is being able to show the public how law is being made and sort of demystify it. And in case the public believed that the law was being made by very wise and informed legislators, we could help show them the opposite. So Senator Ted Stevens was the chairman at the time of the Commerce Committee as a senator. He was essentially the person who should have been the expert on internet regulation. This was the committee that had jurisdiction over the Federal Communications Commission and the internet. And so there was a bill, and it was his bill. He wanted this bill to get through. The bill was for the phone company's benefit, and it was in 2006. And he did not want, and the phone companies did not want, the net neutrality amendment to be put onto that bill. So during what's called a markup, the bill was put in front of the senators in this committee, and one senator proposed a net neutrality amendment. And the vote for the amendment was 11 to 11. It was 10 Democrats and one Republican versus 11 Republicans. And the amendment to put net neutrality on the bill died. We didn't get net neutrality on the bill. However, it was such a contentious fight that it was clear to senators that this wasn't going to be politically easy. So right after that vote, Senator Stevens gave this long, rambling speech, as apparently he'd done for years, give long, rambling speeches. And during that long, rambling speech, he said, "The internet is not a dump trunk, it's a series of tubes." And because of the internet, we were able to take advantage of it. Because of the internet and of our established base and Save the Internet, we were able to put that his speech online. And then what happened next is people emailed to their friends, they shared it, they said, "This is the guy who opposes net neutrality and is in charge of the internet, in charge of regulating the internet." And then not only did people spread it, they also made remixes, and they made techno songs, and the techno songs would have a picture of Ted Stevens, and they would include beats, and you could dance to you could dance to Ted Stevens talking about the internet being a series of tubes. And this went viral. And so with the internet, people were able to communicate and spread this message. And it really showed our opponents for not knowing what they were talking about. And it really helped organize a lot of the public around net neutrality.
In Germany, we have the situation that net neutrality is a topic within blogs, but journalists in mainstream media fear about reporting because it's too complex for them. They can't describe it in 3,000 characters. Was it the same situation in the United States? So was it first a topic in the internet and then it jumped to the mainstream media, or when did mainstream media get involved?
Yeah. So in the US, it's our situation isn't much different from yours, in that the mainstream media doesn't often cover net neutrality. Jon Stewart of The Daily Show has probably covered it more than anyone else, maybe four or five times. And he's probably the best news reporter in the US, even though it's a comedy show. A lot of the cable news channels and the TV news channels don't cover net neutrality. I think big media companies tend not to cover big media policies that would affect media policy. They only cover when the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, punishes them because Janet Jackson showed a boob. They often don't cover things that could affect their bottom line. So what ended up happening is we really had to be very very good at messaging. We had to be very careful in terms of messaging, talking to the press all the time. And once there were enough people on the blogs and on the print media would start reading the blogs and realizing this was an important issue. Once there were lots of important senators and congressmen speaking out in favor of net neutrality, the press was able to turn that into a story. Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton both were co-sponsors of the net neutrality bill in the U.S. And I think there's just a lot of messaging. And still now, there's a lot of tech bloggers will talk about net neutrality, and it only occasionally ripples up to mainstream media. One thing that really helped in terms of rippling it up to mainstream media was having really big fights. Media likes to, often they like to see both sides and they're fighting each other. And so during 2006, there was a vehicle. There was a bill going through Congress, and there was a fight. There were people on one side trying to stop the bill or to put a net neutrality amendment. On the other side, the phone companies were trying to push the bill through. When it came to the Comcast case, there was a fight. There was a story that could be told. There were things that were there were hearings happening, and if there's a hearing, then the media can cover that.
Yeah, let's come to the Comcast case. How did it start? What was it about? And how did you get involved?
Okay. So the Comcast case began in about 2007 in early November. In August, a few months earlier, somebody posted on a blog somewhere that he discovered that Comcast was interfering with his peer-to-peer uploads. Now, during that summer, all of the people who supported net neutrality assumed that the phone and cable companies would not violate net neutrality. The phone and cable companies kept saying, net neutrality is a solution in search of a problem. There is no problem. We haven't interfered with any traffic. We won't interfere with any traffic. And if we ever did, we know that the government will come down on us hard. And so we thought that they wouldn't risk it. They wouldn't risk angering the government by violating net neutrality. But it turned out in 2007, someone discovered that Comcast was interfering with peer-to-peer uploads. And no one really paid attention all that much because Comcast, you know, strenuously denied that it was doing so. It said, we don't interfere with uploads, we've done nothing wrong, and those reports are false. But then the Associated Press did their own study and confirmed, about October 19th, confirmed that Comcast was interfering with these uploads. How I got involved was I was a lawyer at Free Press. I'd been working on net neutrality for a few years. I had deferred my professorship at Nebraska to spend a year at Free Press working on these issues. And when I saw this activity, I realized that this was really the first big net neutrality violation. It was the largest cable company in the country with 12 million, 13 million users, interfering with some of the most popular protocols and applications on the internet with peer-to-peer. And it took me about a week of research to understand how pervasive peer-to-peer was as a technology on the internet. I mean, I realized peer-to-peer was being used to distribute legal TV on a lot of, you know, well-known sites, including major broadcaster sites in the U.S. It was being used to distribute TV content by Miro, which is a nonprofit group up in Boston, which, you know, has thousands of channels anyone can have to stream high-definition TV. I realized NASA was using it, the space agency for the U.S., to show images of outer space. And essentially, these technologies were used by scholars. They were sort of a basic building block, and Comcast didn't really have a good excuse for what they were doing, other than claiming, Comcast was claiming they could do whatever they want, and they had to manage congestion. You know, peer-to-peer was so popular that they had to start interfering with it, which I thought would be very dangerous, because then, you know, if Comcast or a phone company had said in 1996, email is so popular we have to block it, or pictures are so popular we have to block it, we'd still have, you know, the 1996 internet rather than, you know, technologies evolving and expanding as they should.
Okay, you found it out, and then what came next?
So then we had to figure out what to do. And our next step was we filed a complaint with the Federal Communications Commission. We filed a complaint with the Federal Communications Commission partly because the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, had said over and over, if there's ever a problem, we'll act. We have all the authority we need, and we have the will to act against any violation. So we were a little skeptical, because at the time, as it turns out, there are five commissioners, and three commissioners at any one time will come from the president's party. And the president's party, that was George Bush at the time, George Bush's party did not support net neutrality. And all three of the commissioners who were Republican from Bush's party did not support net neutrality. So we filed the complaint, skeptical that the commission would actually follow through on their promises to protect an open internet. And we assumed that if the FCC did nothing, the Republican and FCC ignored our complaint, we would then go to the Democratic Congress and try to get Congress to act and put some pressure on the FCC. But as it turned out, the FCC was really interested in our complaint, partly because what Comcast did was just so over the top. Comcast had been lying about what they were doing. They lied to the public. They were blocking very popular applications. They were even even their legal arguments were very aggressive to the FCC. And so partly because of that, the FCC kept investigating. And as the FCC kept investigating, everything they learned about what Comcast was doing made Comcast look even worse. And so the trajectory of the case is we brought the complaint, we filed it in November. The day after we filed it, 15,000 people filed their own complaint through Save the Internet and Free Press. So we had our complaint, which included all the major consumer groups, as well as law professors at Harvard, Stanford, and Yale, who were all experts in internet technology and who all headed internet and law programs. So we had all the consumer groups, the top law professors, including the leading net neutrality professor, who's German, Barbara von Schewick at Stanford, was on our petition against Comcast. And we had 15,000 individuals who also filed. And a few weeks later, a small company in Silicon Valley, which used peer-to-peer, also filed. So we had really a lot of people who were all concerned about this issue. In the trajectory of the case, what happened, the sort of first step was everyone filed comments to the Federal Communications Commission. That's how our agencies work. You'll file 50, 80 page legal arguments and factual arguments. And every company did that, right? Verizon, AT&T, Comcast, they all filed comments on our petition. And then they all filed reply comments, replying to our comments, etc. This is a way for lawyers in the United States to make a lot of money filing all these comments, and it's a way to inform the FCC about what's going on. But in addition to those comments, we also had two big public hearings, one at Harvard with legal experts and technology experts from MIT and Harvard, and we had a big hearing at Stanford which had also legal and technical experts. And these hearings were actually very, very helpful for the FCC to get informed and were hugely important to get the press involved and to get the public involved and informed. And you know, when it comes to the press, there are some things the press understands really well. And I'll just give you an example of what happened at the Harvard hearing that the press understood even better than they understood network neutrality, which is at Harvard, the hearing was in the moot court room, which is a big room that would hold 200 people maybe. And all five commissioners flew up, as did a whole bunch of lawyers from the industry. And when we showed up at the hearing room, there were already hundreds of people sitting in the room asleep. And these people had been put on a bus and paid by Comcast or somebody who supported Comcast. Comcast still denies it. And what happened is these people would sit in the crowd, and every time the executive from Comcast, who was on the panel next to me, spoke, they would clap for him. and no matter what he said, no matter how silly it was, he would read from whatever his lawyer had put in front of him, and then the crowd would start clapping. And these people clearly were not Harvard or MIT students. They were 20 years older, they were asleep, they afterward, we have pictures of them accepting money, and we interviewed a few who admitted that they were being paid to be there. So the press understood this really well. Even Playboy magazine covered this, the idea that Comcast had to pay people to cheer for them and that nobody else would agree with them. So that was very helpful, to be able to capitalize on mistakes like that, like the Ted Stevens series of tubes mistake or the Comcast mistake. Because when it comes down to it, 99% of the public agrees with Free Press and Save the Internet that the Internet should remain open and free. If you explain it to someone, everyone agrees, except for executives at phone and cable companies. So whenever the phone and cable companies have to do something to advance their cause, like pay people to clap or explain dump trunk analogies to senators, you can capitalize on that and say, here's what the other side is saying. Yeah, you should oppose it.
So Comcast, you won that case?
We won at the FCC. And when we won at the FCC, the Republican chairman voted with the two Democrats to order Comcast to stop what it was doing and to disclose what Comcast had been up to. So, and also the order said essentially that the FCC planned on acting on complaints in the future. And it was seen as a huge victory. It took a lot of political will for the Republican chairman to do that. The Republican chairman had been convinced that what Comcast was doing was wrong. He thought this decision would be a sort of practical middle ground where the FCC could not put forward any broad rule. He was afraid of a broad rule, but that they'd be able to look at the particulars of every case and analyze it. We had been arguing, Free Press had been arguing for a broad rule, which I still think is the right idea, to have a broad rule and then handle every case. But he thought this was the right way to go, and he voted with us, even though the Wall Street Journal was attacking him, saying he was a bad Republican. His own Republican commissioners were attacking him in the Washington Post, saying he was a bad Republican. But this was right around when the banks were collapsing, and people were starting to realize that deregulation had gone too far, and that for the last 8 years, the FCC had been deregulating our internet infrastructure, and it hadn't been working very well. So we won that case. There was great rejoicing. It was a huge consumer victory. There was a woman at one of the other organizations that we had been working with who'd spent 20 years as a consumer advocate on technology and media issues. She wrote a blog post saying it was the biggest victory of her entire career. For 20 years, she'd been waiting for the FCC to rule with the public interest. And what happened was, it was 10 days later, the Comcast appealed the decision. And there are lots of different courts that the appeal could have gone to, and it went to the DC Circuit, which is a very ideological, very pro-corporation circuit. It's the circuit that kept upholding the power of George W. Bush and the president to do whatever he wanted in the supposed war on terror, to torture people, to render them, to hold them in prisons in Guantanamo without anything. And the Supreme Court over and over kept reversing the DC Circuit. The DC Circuit's very ideological. And once the DC Circuit was chosen as the court for the case, I knew we were going to lose, as did the FCC. And so about a year later is when all the briefing had been done and when we argued the case in front of this court. And even though I knew we were going to lose on appeal, the fact that we won at the FCC was a very big deal. It helped organize the public, it helped inform the public and the FCC about these issues, and it ended up really stopping what could have become an industry-wide practice of the cable companies, especially, to secretly block peer-to-peer in different ways. It really showed them that they needed another way of managing their capacity if they were unwilling to invest in more capacity. So there's lots of positive benefits. And going into the court case, the question changed from what it had been at the FCC. Before the FCC, the question was what's the appropriate national policy here? Should we let Comcast continue to block peer-to-peer and therefore sanction any activity by any carrier in the US? Or is the better national policy keeping the internet open and free and announcing that policy? So we won on that as a national policy. And when President Obama won, he's a huge supporter of net neutrality, so we knew that policy would be extended for the next 4 years at least while he was president. And so that was the question at the FCC. At the court, the question became, does the FCC have the authority to adopt this order against Comcast? The court won't decide national internet policy, in theory, right? The court's just supposed to determine whether or not the FCC has the authority to do what it did. And during the argument, I mean, the court was very, very aggressive to the Federal Communications Commission and to me. I argued the case for the consumer groups in supporting the FCC. And it was very clear that the court was skeptical and didn't want to give the FCC the authority to do this without certain changes. And so I knew we were going to lose before. I knew we were going to lose before the argument, I knew we were going to lose during the FCC's argument. So I argued after the FCC, after watching him get questioned very rigorously. And so I wanted really one goal, when I argued, which was to encourage the court to be very clear about what the FCC had to do. I didn't want a loss that was totally unclear, and it'd be the FCC wouldn't know if they had authority or didn't. Congress would say, oh, we don't know, the FCC should figure it out. The FCC would say, oh, let's try again. I want, we'd been debating it for years. I wanted the court to say, the FCC has authority or they don't, very clearly. And I got them to say that. They said, no, there's no authority. The court was very clear. And so now the FCC should know what they have to do in order to protect net neutrality. And it's kind of technical, but they have to reverse some of the initial Bush decisions to move forward.
Okay, now the next steps is you have to remove these these laws, and then you need to go to the higher court, or you can go back to the FCC to do a better law.
Right. So there'd be several options. So the FCC could appeal to a higher court. The DC Circuit is one step below the Supreme Court. If the FCC appeals to the Supreme Court, it might take a long time to do all of that. And in the meantime, the FCC has a mission when it comes to broadband and the internet. They believe they have a mission. The FCC just issued a national broadband plan, finally, for what we should do on the internet. I don't know if you know this about our country, but we're really about like 17th or 18th in the world, the United States, when it comes to everything internet. Speeds, prices, deployment, penetration, we're falling behind a lot of the leaders of the world. And the FCC would like to address some of those issues, would like to expand internet to all Americans. So the FCC doesn't want to wait for the appeal. In addition, the FCC could ask Congress for more clear authority in a certain way. But it would take a long time for Congress to get anything done. Because Congress is very partisan. The Republicans are trying to block everything. The Republicans are very close to the phone and cable companies. And a lot of Democrats are very close to the phone and cable companies because they're such powerful companies that give so much money to politicians in the U.S. So it would take a little while to get the right law through. So the FCC, if the FCC can't rely on Congress or the court to move quickly, the FCC has to look at its own powers. And what happened with the FCC, and this is why the FCC doesn't need to go to court or Congress, is the Bush administration in 2002 to 2005 categorized the internet in a way to give away a lot of its authority. That's essentially what the court said in the Comcast case. Because of how the Bush administration categorized internet access, the FCC has very little authority. So here's what happened. The FCC under Bush said, here's the internet, it's new, there's this new technology. Where does it fit in our Communications Act? Where does it fit in our law? It's either like the phone network, and a network providing access to the internet is like a phone network, or, and then it would be regulated, and we could regulate it under our act, or it's providing access to the internet is just like Twitter or the NewYorkTimes.com. It's just another technology over a network, and we never really regulate those. And because the Bush administration didn't want to regulate, it was a deregulatory administration, they classified the internet, or access to the internet, as being like Twitter. And said, we're not going to regulate it now, it's exempt from all of the rules and Title II of the Communications Act, which governs phone companies. It's in Title I, which means there are no rules, and one day we'll be able to try to regulate it. And the court said, wait a second. So you're telling me that you're going to treat access to the internet like Twitter, and you're going to regulate access to the internet. Does that mean you can regulate Twitter? Does that mean you can regulate Facebook? Can you regulate my pictures? And the FCC said, sure, we can regulate everything. And the court didn't like that. The court said, no. If you want to regulate access to the internet, you're going to have to do it in a way that's within the Communications Act. And so what the FCC has to do is reverse those Bush decisions, properly classify access to the internet as a network, not as Twitter or Facebook, but as a network, and then apply net neutrality. So I think that's what the FCC has to do. That's the next step. And in order to do that, the FCC needs some political will. They need support from the public, and therefore there's people like Free Press and Save the Internet that have to organize the public around this push to give the FCC the authority they need.
Does the FCC changed after the Obama after Obama became a president?
Yes. So after Obama became president, there's always five commissioners, but three of the commissioners come from the president's party. So the former chairman, the Republican chairman, he left. And then the new chairman is a guy named Julius Genachowski. He's a Democrat. He went to law school with Barack Obama, used to play basketball with him. He's an old friend. He worked on the campaign with Obama. And he is supposed to be the author of the technology and innovation agenda that the Obama campaign put out in November of 2007. And that technology agenda very strongly supports net neutrality. And Julius Genachowski, the chairman, has repeatedly said that he strongly supports net neutrality. He has repeatedly said that he strongly supports getting access to the internet for all Americans. And he has repeatedly said that he believes that the FCC has a mission when it comes to broadband to make sure all Americans have access to high-speed open connections. Now, so there are now three votes in favor of net neutrality, not two. And three votes is all you need out of five. So that's how the commission has changed. But the commission, even though the commission has changed and the people have changed, the U.S. government has not changed in a lot of ways that are important. I don't know how it works in Germany, but in the U.S., there are a lot of big, powerful corporations have more power than the average citizen. And the phone and cable companies are very, very adept, are very skilled at controlling and manipulating government. Right? I mean, phone companies didn't compete for, AT&T was a monopoly for 80 years. And what it was good at was controlling government and getting government to give it more money in different ways. And so they're very, very effective. And even for three commissioners who very strongly support net neutrality, they'll face so much political pressure from the phone and cable companies that they really need political pressure on the other side from the public in order to even to get things done.
In Europe, it's a bit another debate on net neutrality. We have more competition. So government is telling us, okay, we don't need regulation because market is working. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with your outside view on the European market?
So I'm not an expert on the European market, but in terms of reading and thinking about net neutrality and competition, I don't agree. I don't think competition is enough. So let me give an analogy, then I'll give two arguments. The analogy is, think of cars, right? People could say, we don't need to regulate cars and make sure they have airbags and that they don't explode because we have competition. And then you can choose one car or another. Right? Or we don't need privacy laws because there are so many different websites that if one website violates your privacy, you'll just use another. It turns out markets are more complicated than that. You often need real consumer protections for things that we really care about because there's no need to trust the market to deliver that outcome. Often the market can't deliver the outcome when it comes to privacy or even safety because of bad incentives in the market. And so from a big picture point of view, markets are wonderful. Markets allocate goods well. They provide people with consumer choice. But we believe in markets because of the outcomes, because they help people in different ways. We don't believe in markets because God came down and said, let there be markets. And if the market leads to problems that are harmful to consumers and to citizens, then you simply need to tweak the market and change it with regulation or impose a rule. So that's sort of my big picture thought before getting to specifics. When it comes to net neutrality, there are two reasons why the market might not be enough. One, when you look at Canada, what you have in Canada is you have carriers that are required to provide access to independent internet service providers. So an independent provider will lease access from the phone company, But often those phone companies will themselves throttle BitTorrent or block BitTorrent or peer-to-peer. And then the access that's provided to the independent ISP, they have no choice but to use that network in that way. So even though all the ISPs have access to the network, they have to apply the same exact conditions as the carrier. Right? So that's one issue. Another issue is that often, even if that wasn't going on, often all the companies would have the same exact incentives. They'd have the same bad incentives, just as lots of companies have bad incentives to violate privacy and to do it secretly. And when it comes to cybersecurity, a lot of technologies have an incentive to put their technologies out as quickly as possible and get it to market, even if all of the bugs haven't been worked out. You often have sort of bad incentives in the market. And even though there's, you often see some minimal competition, the competition won't be enough, and an open internet is so important that it should just be made a basic rule, even if the market doesn't deliver it.
Oh, I totally agree.
Okay. I hope I said that well.
Yeah. Another threat for net neutrality in Europe is a copyright lobby. Because yes. they demand with all their lobby power several things, like first blocking peer-to-peer, blocking peer-to-peer websites, or to slow peer-to-peer, and to cut down users' internet if they will find out that someone is doing file sharing for several times. Do you have the same debate in United States?
We do have a debate in the United States. Unfortunately, the copyright lobby in the US is really powerful, maybe even more powerful than in Europe. And the copyright lobby is very close to the Democrats. And the Democrats tend to be the party that's more in favor of net neutrality. So when it comes down to it, the Democrats who support net neutrality often are very close to Hollywood. Therefore, they'll only support net neutrality for lawful content, meaning not for copyrighted content. You gave a few examples that I think in the U.S., to the extent there's debate, here's how it would shake down. I think if the copyright lobby pushed for blocking a technology, like blocking peer-to-peer, I don't think that would work very well as a legal matter, because it would be so overbroad. Peer-to-peer is used, to be honest, for lots of legal purposes. And there are in the United States different legal tests that we apply at the Supreme Court for whether or not a technology is liable for the copyright infringement of the people using it. And the test comes from the VCR cases, as well as a recent peer-to-peer case. So blocking the whole technology would be, I think, a tough argument. But the copyright companies want the ability to make a deal with internet service providers like AT&T. AT&T is a big proponent of this idea. AT&T, the carrier, wants to be able to make deals with copyright companies and then spy on or police all the traffic going on over the internet on AT&T, and then pick out all of the copyrighted materials that violate copyright and block them all. Now, the problem with that, and AT&T, of course, wants to get a kickback, some money from the entertainment companies for doing that. So there's a reason why the entertainment companies want to do that. They feel that they're losing money from people file sharing and not paying for their content. No matter how legitimate that interest is, there are huge costs to choosing that sort of enforcement through the ISPs. And so the ISPs, one, they have to spy on everyone and everything you're doing. So there's a privacy cost. Two, once the internet service providers start blocking or slowing down or doing whatever to copyrighted materials, then consumers will switch to encrypting their traffic. They'll start encrypting almost all their traffic. And so what you have is an arms race. It just, and arms races often don't turn out well. One side increases their spying on the public, and the public will end up encrypting. And a side effect might be that legitimate law enforcement is impeded because of the encryption. And what ends up happening is, after just really a few weeks or a few months of the ISPs being able to monitor copyrighted material, the internet, there's all this encryption everywhere, and it no longer works. And you change the internet forever for just a few months of being able to filter out copyright. It seems like there's got to be a better way of doing it. And I hope the copyright industry starts to embrace more. I mean, it seemed like the copyright industry was embracing making their content available on the internet more and more through iTunes and other legitimate means. But it seems like their lobbyists are still stuck on this idea that they need to stop and block any illegal file transfers rather than providing consumers with what they want.
From your experiences with Free Press and Save the Internet, what can you tell us here in Germany and Europe how we can fight for net neutrality?
There's probably a lot of different things that you have to keep in mind, and every situation is different. I think the number one thing is get really talented people working on it, and you guys do have some very talented people in Europe working on this issue and thinking about it. You've got you, you've got Jeremy Zimmerman, there are others. There's no replacement for or substitute for really talented people who are working really hard, who are thinking about these issues daily and can respond to what's going on from the carriers. It's a game of chess. They'll make a move, you'll make a move. So inspiring really talented people. And I don't want to understate that. One of the reasons why I worked for Free Press, and I deferred a professorship. I asked my school to let me spend another year in D.C. working for Free Press because I was so impressed by their team, an amazing researcher, an amazing political analyst, an exceptional press secretary, really great campaign team. Right? And so there was such an exceptional group of people that I wanted to work with them. And when I left, I ended up hiring several lawyers over the past few years as advising Free Press, and the lawyers I've hired are all graduates of Harvard, Yale, Stanford, top schools who took huge pay cuts to be part of the organization because they wanted to work with other great people. So if you assemble good people, other good people really want to work with you, and I can't underestimate that. So that's one, is recruit great people. Two, use the internet to save the internet. Organize, think strategically about how to get the public involved, how to get the press to understand the issue and to cover it, and tie that as closely as you can to what's actually going on in the halls of power. Right? You can waste a lot of resources in organizing sort of in the wrong way at the wrong time, rather than organizing when it matters most and for the right politicians in the right areas, the swing votes, the two or three votes you really need at the exact right time. And another thing is just constantly be building your list and constantly be explaining and educating the public about what's going on. Constantly inform the public and treat them like adults that will understand the issue and try to simplify the message for the public. And the advice that I tend to give is to not be afraid of fighting in public. Right? If the fight's going to happen behind closed doors, then the public is going to lose. Because behind closed doors, often the phone and cable companies and the other powerful corporations have the most power. So you really need transparency, a fight out in sunlight. You need a big public fight to get the public involved. And so the public knows who's on their team and who isn't, and knows when they can be active in this debate.
Okay, yeah, thank you.
Sure, thank you, Marcus.
I think I have no more questions, or is anything we forgot to talk about?
Let me think. The only, I guess it might make sense to explain how net neutrality benefits innovation and how net neutrality benefits democracy.
Yeah, sure.
Would that be helpful?
Just do it.
I don't know. So net neutrality is not just a democracy policy, not just an economic policy, but it's both. So when it comes to economics, the open internet has been a huge driver of wealth and innovation. People use the internet as a general purpose technology. And general purpose technologies are the kinds of things that drive economic growth in any country, because people can choose how to use this technology as an input to lots of other things. And so think of electricity, general purpose technology. You can plug in anything to a wall socket and it'll work. You can create anything, invent anything, and it'll be able to take advantage of the general purpose electricity grid. And that's what the internet is and has been. So you invent any application, like an application for monitoring your supply chain as a manufacturer, and you save costs on creating products, and that promotes your innovation, because now you can invest more in new products. You invent Twitter, you invent Facebook, you invent eBay, or you invent anything on this general purpose technology. You don't need permission from anyone, and it results in considerable growth. And people will say, but if you have a really good idea, you know, if you have a good idea like eBay or Twitter, can't you just go to a bank and get the money and go to the phone company and get permission? But as it turns out, that's not how innovation works on the internet. And this, the German professor Barbara Van Schevik has done the most research on this, is that a lot of the biggest innovations on the internet were successful before they got any money from anyone. They were complete accidents. eBay was a weekend Labor Day project by some guy and then became hugely popular. Google was a thesis project. Yahoo was just a way of cataloging. It was also an academic project. Twitter was the side company of this one guy who was trying to start another company. He got money for another company, and that company failed, and the side project of Twitter took off. And so the kinds of things that have been really popular, Facebook was just a way for a few kids at Harvard to meet women. Right? The way that a lot of these billion-dollar companies have taken off has been purely accidental, with people being able to choose what technologies they want to use without getting permission from anyone. So that's you know, very cheap cost innovation has resulted in huge gains. And then when it comes to democracy, the internet has been the most democratic medium out there. In the US, Barack Obama would not be president if it weren't for the internet. It was through the internet that he was able to spread his videos, he was able to spread his messages, he was able to get people to organize at mybarackobama.com. If it weren't for the internet, everyone in the US knows that Hillary Clinton probably would have won. She probably would have been the nominee for the Democrats. Obama wouldn't have been able to raise as much money, get the message out, anything like that. And so the openness of the internet ensures that people can organize and communicate with one another. If you have to get permission from your phone or cable company, you have lots of examples in the US especially of speech that can't get through the phone and cable company. There was a few years ago, somebody wanted to use text messaging to promote an abortion rights issue, and an abortions group wanted to communicate with their own members about abortion rights, and a phone company said no, and they turned down the ability to do that. They later changed their mind when the New York Times covered it, but they had to get permission for that. Recently, on the iPad, there was an example that Apple turned down an application for a cartoonist who won the Pulitzer Prize in the US, a big journalism prize, because he was ridiculing public figures. And I haven't looked into all the details of that, I just read about the story quickly, but can you imagine having to get permission on the internet from some company to be able to ridicule public officials? And so what's really at stake is the ability to speak without permission to whoever you want, with any technology you want. And that's why we have so many organizations on the right and left who care deeply about this issue. It's not just about economic innovation, although that's very, very important. It's also about what goes to the core of any society, which is their democratic institutions, their freedom of speech, their freedom to associate with people who agree with them, and to learn about the issues of their day.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Marcus.